It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Darrell Connor. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, after more than 100 years of attempts, Congress has voted to make lynching a federal crime. We'll talk about the laws meeting in 2018 and look back at the human cost of racial violence.
First, last October, researchers announced they'd be looking into water quality in private wells in southwestern Wisconsin.
The move came in the face of growing concern about groundwater contamination in the region. And with the first phase of research complete, new findings have been released that are adding to that concern.
Hope Kerwin is a reporter for WPR News based in La Crosse. Hope, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Now, what were researchers looking for when they were testing the wells in southwestern Wisconsin?
So this is the first part of a two-year study that's taking place in three counties in southwestern Wisconsin. So they tested 301 private wells. They sent kits out to the homeowners, the well owners, and they took samples of their water. And they were looking for levels of bacteria and nitrates to understand the water quality in these areas.
And which counties were they?
So this is Grant, Iowa, and Lafayette County. So down in the southwestern part of the state, this is also known as kind of the driftless area. So, you know, it's an interesting kind of geography and topography there.
Right. We've heard and we've talked on this show a lot about Kewaunee County in northeastern Wisconsin, almost the opposite side of the state, and concerns about these kinds of contamination. Is this something that people have been at least worried about in southwestern Wisconsin in years past?
Yeah, so there are similarities in the kind of the geography of these regions. They share the same kind of bedrock, and that is that fractured and porous. So it allows water and therefore sometimes contaminants to travel down into the groundwater. And so people have been kind of quick to point that out. But in talking with a conservationist in Iowa County about this, she was quick to point out the differences between places like Kewaunee County and Iowa County, where she's at. She pointed out that there are no CAFOs or concentrated animal feeding operations, large farms that are common in Kewaunee County. There are none of those in Iowa County. Those places are a little bit more spread out. The population centers are not as concentrated as the Northeast. So, there are some differences between the areas.
All right, let's dig into the results now of the testing. What were some of the key findings of as you say, this first round of testing?
So of the 301 private wells, 42% of those wells were considered unsafe based on state standards for bacteria and nitrates. So they were looking at coliform bacteria, total coliform numbers. So coliform bacteria isn't in and of itself illness causing, but it is used as an indicator when looking at water quality as that there could be disease causing bacteria or parasites or other things in the water that could cause illness. So 34% of the samples tested positive for total coliform numbers, and 4% of the samples tested positive for E. coli. So that is actually an illness-causing bacteria that's found in human and animal waste, and those well owners were immediately notified that they had E. coli. That's a pretty serious, can be pretty serious in a water. So those well owners were notified so that they could have their wells disinfected. 16% of the wells also tested above the state standard for nitrates. So nitrates are a compound that are associated with something called blue baby syndrome. And so that's where it's fatal for infants because their blood can't carry oxygen to the rest of their body. So it's particularly dangerous for infants and pregnant women. But they're also finding that high nitrate levels can be associated with things like colorectal cancer, thyroid disease, and central nervous system defects.
I know this study is in the early stages, but are there ideas about where this contamination is coming from?
So that will actually be kind of the next steps of this study. They're planning to do another round of private well testing in the spring, and just to kind of compare the two seasons. These tests were taken in November. And so once they have that data about where contamination is in these areas, they're going to also look at kind of where these wells are located, the construction of these wells, and then other factors around them that could be causing contamination. even though we've seen other studies and other information come out about kind of the human or animal sources for these contaminants, you know, the researchers were really very quick to say that we don't know where the contamination is coming from right now. You know, previous testing has not been very extensive in this part of the state, and so there's not a lot of good data to understand where the contamination is coming from.
We're talking to Hope Kerwin, WPR reporter based in La Crosse, looking at recent testing of wells in southwestern Wisconsin, three counties there, finding high levels of worrisome contaminants or indicators of possible contamination in many of those wells. Hope, we mentioned northeastern Wisconsin. Now, there are 15 counties in that part of the state that are going to be under stricter rules for getting rid of manure to protect their groundwater from contamination. Those I don't think are in effect yet, but those don't apply at all to these counties we're talking about in southwestern Wisconsin. Is that right?
That is correct.
Is there any, as you talk to people in the area, and as you mentioned, researchers are not saying this is a manure problem at this stage. Are people talking about, hey, maybe we should be thinking about new guidelines for possible water contamination here?
So the county conservationist that I talked to from Iowa County, she said that eventually they are hoping to be able to use this data and the information about where contamination is coming from in this area to be able to make decisions about, you know, how farmers can spread manure or how people can use fertilizers and other decisions about septic systems or other well systems, how wells should be constructed. She's hoping that this data will help inform those kinds of policy and regulation decisions in the future.
Now, this was a random sampling, but I think there was that same conservationist you were just talking about who was randomly selected as one of the sample people, right? What did she have to say about how the process worked, you know, as a homeowner?
Yeah, she actually, her well, private well, came up as part of the random sampling. So she got to go through the process of, you know, going, taking the water sample, sending it into the lab and receiving the results. And actually, even though she said that, you know, she does test her private well, her well results came back as positive for the total coliform, that non-illness causing bacteria that could indicate that there are other illness causing things in her water. So she said she's actually going to be following her own advice. And, you know, they advise people that did have their wells test positive to confirm those results by getting another test. Those are fairly low cost. And if that second test comes back as positive, you can then have your well disinfected. And that's a pretty effective way to address the total coliform or the E. coli bacteria.
Now, again, this is the first stage in a longer-term study. What are the next steps now?
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, they're going to be doing another round of testing in the spring just to get more data. And then they'll be diving in deeper into kind of the geography of the area, understanding, you know, where these wells are dug and the construction of the wells, you know, even as far as when they were built, kind of the design. You know, those are all important indicators of how contamination could be getting into the groundwater and how that could be impacting the larger situation.
We'll leave it there for now. Hope, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
That was Hope Kerwin, WPR news reporter based in La Crosse. She was with us to talk about the results of a study that found more than 40% of a sample of private wells in Grant, Iowa, and Lafayette counties had unsafe levels of contamination.
In response to the study's results, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss announced today that he'd be creating a task force to look at water quality issues across the state. In a statement, he called reports of groundwater contamination in southwestern Wisconsin, quote, disturbing, and added that every Wisconsinite should have access to safe, clean drinking water.
Coming up, we'll look back at America's history of racial violence after Congress voted last month to make lynching a federal crime. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about some great fiction books published in 2018 that we might have missed out on, and you could share your favorite books of the year, too.
Right now, the first bill to establish federal penalties for lynching, was introduced in 1918. That bill and more than 200 other attempts in Congress to curb mob violence targeting African Americans failed to become law. But before the holidays, the Senate voted unanimously to make lynching a federal crime.
The bipartisan Justice for Victims of Lynching Act was introduced by Senators Kamala Harris, Tim Scott, and Cory Booker. Here's Booker speaking about the bill on the Senate floor.
The passage of this bill is a recognition of that dark past. We know that when wrongs are ignored, they fester underneath the skin of the body politics, and we know that justice delayed is justice denied.
Chad Dion Lassiter is a national expert on race relations and the executive director of the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Can you start off by giving our listeners a sense of the human cost that lynching and mob violence has had for African Americans?
Well, it's played a tremendous, it's had a tremendous impact on the identities as well as the emerging identities of African Americans in America. When we look at Billie Holiday, when she articulated in her song Strange Fruit, which ironically was written by a Jewish school teacher, we're talking about that stored history, that past in which it's a dark side, that shadow of hate that put black bodies on display. And it wasn't just lynching, but it was also a ritual that ended up engaged with the lynching. It was almost like a rites of passage. Let's lynch, let's come to the central catchment area, and the townspeople would come. And so it's part of that dark history, it's part of that dark past. And when we ask the question, Socratically and otherwise, why has it taken so long? We have to be able to respond by simply articulating that change in America is not only painfully slow, but oftentimes purposefully slow.
You know, there have been hundreds of attempts at passing federal anti-lynching legislation of some sort, and you talked about the fact that it took a long time for this to pass. What were some of the high-profile efforts that ended up not succeeding?
Well, we know of the efforts of Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, who was the founder of the Niagara Movement, with some of his Jewish colleagues that morphed into the NAACP. We also know that he brought attention to this through the Crisis magazine. We also know that Ida B. Wells was an anti-lynching crusader who brought attention to this. And we know that these were times where white supremacy was running rampant. It was unacknowledged, it was unchecked, and it was part of the institutional policies of prejudice plus power, which gave us institutional racism maintained by the government at that time. And so these efforts really went on deaf ears. You had organizations like I mentioned before, the National Association of Advancement for Colored People. You had the National Association of Colored Women. You had the Association for Southern Women for the Prevention of Lynching. And then you had the Dyer anti-lynching bill that was proposed in 1920. And so now we look at that historical trajectory and we come to this contemporary era. And I won't say that those efforts fell. I would say those efforts, even though it's 100 years later, served as a catalyst for us to get to this point.
Chad Dion Lassiter is a national expert on race relations and the executive director of the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission, and we're talking about the Senate voting unanimously, bipartisan, to make lynching a federal crime. Chad, even though laws may not have gotten passed, you know, there have been other African-American activists. You talked about W.E. Du Bois and others who have been working for well over 100 years to make this issue and continue to make it visible in front of people. What are some of the other ways they continue to do that?
Through their writings, through their lecturings, building coalitions with their Jewish colleagues. You had the abolitionist movement bringing attention to it, protesting, civil disobedience, things of that nature. We know that when we look at historical incidents like Rosewood, when we look at incidents of, you know, Mississippi and things of that nature, these were individuals who were committed to seeing the humanity of what they were called at that time Negroes, but what we see now in the contemporary is African Americans. And so in seeing that humanity, one of the things they wanted to do is bring attention to it. Oftentimes, the history books never really articulates those individuals who lost their lives, who were white on the other side of the color line, fighting on behalf of, you know, blacks and trying to really highlight their humanity. And so one of the things that we have to look at is that it's similar to the apology for slavery so many years later. It's symbolic, but it also, this bill will allow us in this emboldened era that displays with xenophobia, homophobia, Islamophobia, white terrorism, white supremacy, and institutional racism, that if a lynching was to take place now, we have the federal backing to go after the people and not just condemn them, but with the law on our side as an instrument of justice and change, we can actually, you know, do some things from a punitive standpoint.
Now, a mob lynching is usually about a lot more than just murder. Can you talk about the social function that lynchings have played in America?
Yes, well, it could be the perception of someone looking at you the wrong way. So even though Emmett Till, that lynching was maybe not with the noose, which is a symbol and stain of hatred, and maybe it didn't have the Confederate flag, but Emmett Till, who was the African-American young man from Chicago, comes down to Mississippi. It was alleged on one side that he, whenever he got nervous, he stuttered, and his mother asked him to whistle because that would calm him down. The other side was that he whistled at a white woman, and that was just tantamount to, you know, leading into, you know, the potential of lynching. Well, his lynching occurred on the back of a boat in the Mississippi River, and his face was charred by the, you know, the boat motor and things of that nature. We've also seen in the contemporary, if you look at some of the things that have happened now in the Me Too movement, when women are coming forward against powerful men, and because of male privilege, the women who have been victims of sexual harassment oftentimes are castigated, or we're told, well, that really didn't happen, or why did it take all this time to happen? And so we see a high-tech lynching through the media, similar to what we saw with regards to Anita Hill when Clarence Thomas was being confirmed. And so in the social context of that, it may not be the physical thing of nooses, but is the way we defame people's characters, the way that we negate people's narratives, whether it be transphobia, homophobia, or xenophobia.
You talked about Emmett Till and what made him a target. What were some of the other things that usually precipitated a lynching or made someone a more likely target?
It's just the reign of white supremacy and racial terror and white supremacy. So if you look at Rosewood as a case example, in Rosewood it was a white woman who claimed that a black man raped her when actually she was two-timing. That's the terminology they used at that time. She was having a relationship outside of the confines of her marriage, but a whole town burned. In Tulsa, it was a similar accusation of a black man raping a white woman. There's a story that we oftentimes don't talk about in our modern day politics, but it was the Ballad of Leo Frank. Leo Frank was a Jewish individual who actually was lynched because it was alleged that he actually raped a white woman. And so these things were precipitated simply by falsehoods, alternative facts, if you will, erroneous data. It could be a glare, it could be a stare, or it could just be the mere fact that there were individuals who had some inferiority problems, but they wanted to pretend like they were superior. So it's the church burnings, it's the cross burnings, it's the long-storied history of the shadow of hate of the Ku Klux Klan that were against Jews, that were against African-Americans and others.
You talked about Tulsa, and you also talked about Rosewood as well. Why were politicians from southern states so resistant to anti-lynching laws? Was it merely just to keep the support of white southern voters, or was it about something else?
I think it's both and. You raise a great question. I think it was to keep the support of the white southern voters, but it also was the maintaining of the system of white supremacy. You know, parts of our democracy profited from white supremacy and institutional racism, denying the vote of individuals. And then also it was used as a fear-mongering tactic. If you could lynch a person, that would keep other individuals in line as it relates to segments of the population that may wanted to revolt. And so when you lynch them, it was just gruesome. And not only did it come at the expense of just solely a lynching, but oftentimes individuals had their body parts, you know, castigated, and then they were actually used as props and things of that nature. And so it was definitely fear. It was definitely not having the moral compass or the more imperative to do the right thing. We heard the same thing with the storied history and the original sin of our democracy, as explained in slavery, by simply saying, well, you know, it wasn't the right time to free slaves. And so it's the same thing with lynching. White Southerners wanted to keep them maintaining status quo. You wanted to keep the division for them not to see the humanity of their neighbors, i.e. Blacks. And so then you had politicians who maintained the status quo of white supremacy of that era.
We have less than 3 minutes, so I just have a couple more questions for you. We talked a lot about what went on in the South, but do Northern states share in this responsibility too?
I think we all do. You raise a great question. I think that a lot of us were implicit by standing by and not doing the things that we needed to do as it relates to advocating. So we look at it as a Southern phenomenon, but we have enough data that shows that lynchings took place in places like Delaware and elsewhere. And so I think, once again, it doesn't become an either-or, but it becomes a both-and. There were Northern leaders. There were Southern leaders who stood by. I think the relevance in 2018 is that this federal law puts us in a position to look at this emboldened era that we find ourselves. And I think that for the United States of America, we still have a lot of work to do as it relates to that reckoning of the history of violence towards African Americans and others in our democracy.
Yeah, and that was actually a question I was going to ask you. And just to expand on that, what kind of things do you think that the United States has to do when it comes to dealing with African Americans? Not just this lynching and making it a federal crime, but what are some of the other things that you think in a minute or less that we need to reckon with?
Certainly, in a minute or less, I think that we have to deal with the historical underpinnings. We have to look at the generational trauma. We need to also make sure we do coalition building. At one particular point in time, our Jewish and African-American communities were strong. We have to get back to that. I think from a policy standpoint, we have to look at mass incarceration. We have to look at educational apartheid. We have to look at economic injustice. And there are a lot of other challenges that we have as well. The way that we see not just mass incarceration, but police brutality by some white officers and some black officers, where we negate people's humanity and we're shooting them unarmed and then we're getting off with impunity. So I think that beyond apologies, this bill goes a long way, but we also have to have a frank conversation about the impact of institutional racism, not just on African Americans, but on people of color, and it also disadvantages whites. And so I think it's time to call for a national conversation that moves from theory to practice here in our democracy.
Chad, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Chad Dion Lassiter is a national expert on race relations and the executive director of the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. He was with us to talk about the significance of Congress voting to make lynching a federal crime.
Coming up after the news, are you looking for a good read? We're joined by Milwaukee bookseller Daniel Golden of the Boswell Book Company for a look at the best fiction of 2018. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Darrell Conner. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up, we'll talk to a personal finance expert about how to have some of those difficult conversations about money in a relationship.
First, winter is a great time to work through a reading list, especially if your New Year's resolution involves more time for books. We'll take some of the work for you out of searching for a great read by taking some time to talk about 2018's best fiction.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you enjoyed some new fiction this year? And if you didn't have a chance to read it, you can still share a book you're looking forward to reading. Share what's on your reading list. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Daniel Golden joins us now in the studio to talk about his top picks for the best fiction of the last year. He's the owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. Daniel, good to have you back with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, here's my problem. We're talking about new fiction. And I read a lot of nonfiction, too. I got a bunch of books at home I want to read. I've got my holds at the library. I've got books I want to buy. I just can't keep up. You're in the business. Do you feel overwhelmed?
Oh, completely. And as do all our customers, if you don't have a pile of books by your bedside, then you're not really doing your job as a bookseller or a reader. So it is hard. And sometimes I have to challenge myself to keep on task because people do want to know what booksellers are reading and what we think of things. So
that's a great segue because I was going to ask you, and just starting with you, what were some of your favorite books in 2018 that you read?
Well, I've I have to say it's hard to come up with what your favorite book was, but we are obligated to do it. And so I thought long and hard about it. I thought about all the books and what it means. Like, everybody has a different reason. I like a book that has wonderful plots and characters and is well written, but I also have a thing for something that gives me some emotional heft. So there are some books that I really admired this year, but I didn't fall in love with them. And that doesn't mean that they're happy endings or romances. It just means I took them very personally. So I decided in the end my favorite book was a book called The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay, set in Chicago in the 1980s in contemporary Paris, about two art exhibitions. A lot of people said it's sort of the first book about AIDS to kind of have a sweep of time. It's also one of the first books not to be set in New York, San Francisco, or London.
Now, tell us a little more about that. You've got, by the way, I should give a visual. you brought a stack of all your top 10 books, or most of them anyway. Yeah, it's teetering precariously next to me here. If I'm injured, we'll know why. Tell us a little more about that top pick of the year.
Well, I will say that one of the things that's been nice about the book is it has some momentum on its own. It's showing up on a lot of best of lists. It was on Entertainment Weekly's top 10. It was on the New York Times top 10 for the year. Publishers Lunch, which is a trade magazine, took 58 best of lists and compiled them into one best of list. The best of lists are exploding because people post them online for clicks, mm-hmm. needless to say. People love lists, and they do really well. So everyone and, you know, Farming Monthly Vermont has their top 10 books of the year somewhere online. So that was one. Last year, I loved a book that nobody seemed to love except me. And that was sort of like bicycling in a really windy day where you don't get anywhere. It was called, I will give it a plug for it.
Sure.
It's called Lonesome Lies Before Us by Don Lee. And it's still in hardcover. It didn't go out in paperback. So, like I said, Paris by the Book. And I also, you get, in a bookstore, you get a lot of response from customers, what they like. And it's so much fun when you recommend a book and people come back to you and say, oh my gosh, I love that book.
Nice.
I hugged that book. It was amazing. I want 10 copies for other people. Or I told 10 people to get it from the library, whatever. Anything works. And that's a book that's resonated with a lot of people. So that's been really nice.
Have you been seeing any changes or any trends in the publishing industry as far as what type of fiction that we're seeing more of? And will that continue?
Oh, sure. There's always trends. And I would say some things are fads and some things are trends. So one thing that's been really great is a lot of underrepresented groups have much more access to publication. And that's really been represented well with more Black, Latino, Asian writers. Possibly the best reviewed book of 2018 was a book, an amazing book called They're There by Tommy Orange. It did not. It did show up as the number one book of the compilations and showed up on a lot of top 10 lists. It's a Native American writer, and there just really haven't been a lot of young Native American writers being published by the big houses with some aggressiveness in fiction. In poetry, yes, but not in fiction. And I'm really hoping that that book really opens the doors to a lot of other Indigenous writers. It's set in Oakland, and it's about an urban powwow, and it's a lot of different characters. Let me just say it starts off like with a punch in the face, but you just can't stop going. And it's a little open-ended. So for people who are a little like a pat ending or want to know what happened to everybody at the end, I'm just giving you a little warning, but amazing.
We're talking to Daniel Golden from Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, looking at some of the best fiction of 2018. We invited you to weigh in on Facebook. Kevin picked two books, Asymmetry by Lisa Halliday and the book you were just talking about, They're There by Tommy Orange. Now, we've got a couple, Daniel, Wisconsin authors on your list as well. I don't want to miss those. Let's talk about Lucy Tan and What We Were Promised.
The two books go together.
Okay,
so
talk about both.
I'm going to start with Chloe Benjamin's The Immortalist, one of the best, a surprise bestseller, second novel, Madison writer. I have a very emotional connection because I got to read the book very early and fell in love with it and helped tell other people who told other people who told other people, wound up a New York Times bestseller, and also was top 10 of the year on Entertainment Weekly. It's about four kids, siblings, who go to a fortune teller and find out when they're going to die.
Ooh.
So, terrific book coming out in paperback pretty soon. And from Chloe Benjamin, I learned about Lucy Tan's What We Were Promised. It's a first novel. It was definitely acquired. It's my sleeper on the list. It probably made some best of lists, but I didn't find them. Mm-hmm. It's set in contemporary Shanghai, and it's about a couple who are born in China, move to the United States where they're educated and get good jobs. The husband comes back to run a business, and the wife doesn't really have a job. She's sort of, they call her in China, a housewife without any housework to do. And his long-lost brother is on his way to visit, and of course, his wife and the brother have a little secret relationship. The story is told through the husband, the wife, and the maid. And the thing about the story is, of course, the maid and the husband and wife, it's just luck of circumstances that one is in one place and one is in the other. It's a heartbreaking, warm, funny book, and I'm just really excited to know about it. So,
we had another Facebook commentator mention some books that they had read and enjoyed, and there's also one on your list as well. Leslie wrote that she liked Florida by Lauren Groff, You'll Think It, I'll Say It stories by Curtis Sittenfeld, and My Sister, the Serial Killer by Oyinka Braithwaite, which actually made your list. And then also My Sister, the Serial Killer made your list too. Why'd you like that?
Well, you were asking about trends, and I have a trend for you.
Okay.
And they are these little, this goes in and out of fashion, but it's really hot right now to publish these little tiny books, small trim size. In many cases, they're just short stories or essays. So you had George Saunders published one. Stephen King published one. Khaled Hosseini published one. David Graham did a nonfiction one, which was just an essay. Mm-hmm. So this is the way My Sister, the Serial Killer. It's a cute little package filled with murder. And what I really love about the book is that it has that sort of sociopath quality, but yet it's blended to a lot of traditional Nigerian storytelling in this style. The author, who you did a great job of pronouncing her name, thank you very much for doing that, is a student of Abe Adebayo, and I have really apologized, but she had a book called Stay With Me a couple of years ago that was also a big hit here. So I love that customer because she would come in and I would have like three or four other books to recommend to her. Florida is showing up on a lot of best of lists and has definitely made the top 10. I don't know why I didn't read it. I read some short story collections, but I didn't get to it. But I was a huge fan of Fates and Furies, her last novel. I also love Curtin Sittenfeld. So what? She has great taste.
We're talking with Daniel Golden, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, about his list of best fiction books of 2018.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you enjoyed some great fiction this year, either new or new to you? Call in and tell us about it. If you didn't have a chance to read it, tell us what's at the top of your list. You can even share some great nonfiction that you read over the past year, too. Or if you have a question, if you need kind of one of those, I like blank, what else should I read? Daniel, I promise he will have 100% foolproof answer. All right, maybe not, but he'll probably have something for you. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Right now, we're talking with Daniel Golden, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, about his top 10 fiction titles from 2018.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's a book you really enjoyed in 2018? New or, again, new to you? Are there some new books you had a chance to read? What's on your list, or do you need a recommendation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. By the way, we're going to have Daniel's list up at WPR.org. To your calls now. Jessica is with us in Ashland. Jessica, do you have a book for us?
I do. It's by one of my favorite authors, Louise Erdrich. And this was actually published in 2017, but it's Future Home of the Living God. And very interesting story set in northern Minnesota. So kind of feels close to home as I'm reading it.
Jessica, thanks. My wife is a big fan of Louise Erdrich. I still haven't read any. Should I, Daniel?
Yes, I'm not sure. Well, actually, and Future Homeless Living God is a perfect book for you because it's speculative.
And I do like my science fiction.
Right, so this is a way you can please your wife and yourself at the same time.
Woohoo! thank you so much for the suggestion, Jessica. Appreciate it.
Let's talk about the book that you sold the most at Boswell Books, Paris by the Book by Liam Callahan. What was it about that book that was so popular at your store?
You know, it is funny. I feel like it's a book that we took nine years to set up to sell. Because when I first opened the store in 2009, one of the first people I met was Liam Callahan, who was actually running the creative writing program at UWM at the time. And he said, "I'm so excited about this bookstore. Let's do a whole bunch of stuff and poetry bus and student readings." And we came up with we have a graduate student reading once a year, but we also have undergraduate readings that has grown to like 8 different schools in the Milwaukee area have picked their kids to read. And he just brought in authors to interview. And then he told me the book was coming and it was set in a bookstore and it was set in a Paris bookstore. I was like, holy, that blows the mind of many, many, many people. Because it's sort of, we have this joke that you put the Eiffel Tower on anything and it sells better. It's sort of like the Portlandia bird. And so we were ready. And then the book just turned out to have all these followers and people were loving it. And in some ways, because the book is sort of about nostalgia, but the way normally Americans have nostalgia for Paris, this is a family in Paris with nostalgia for Wisconsin. So it's in a way, it's very much a Wisconsin novel, and even specifically a Milwaukee novel. But at one point, the couple at the center of the book go throughout Europe by traveling to all the cities in Wisconsin that have European names. So that's what happens. The husband disappears. The wife and her daughters go off to Paris where they take over this bookstore and try to find the husband. It's sort of it's inspiration sort of Madeline, the old Madeline story, and also the Red Balloon, which many people saw in elementary school, the black and white version. Those are two visions of Paris, sort of the adventurous vision and the gritty version. It's romantic and it's a lovely book that sort of captures why people love books. And let me just say, bookstore books do really well in bookstores.
Let's go to another caller now. Janine is with us in Eau Claire. How can we help you out, Janine?
Hi, I'm looking for a recommendation, please.
Right.
I have been reading, looking for someone I connect to the way I did the gal Elizabeth Salander in the Millennium series.
Elizabeth Salander. So did you read Children of Blood and Bone?
No.
That's the hot YA fantasy book from this year. People just love it. It showed up. 800 booksellers are on this Publishers Weekly Facebook page where they pick their favorite books of the year. And I think it showed up number 5.
Wow.
So I would say, Salander, this is the book for you. You need to stop what you're doing and run to a library or something and get one, or a bookstore.
All right. Go. Stop listening, Janine. Children of Blood and Bone is the title?
Yes.
Okay.
It's all downhill from here.
Let's go to another call. Let's go to Debbie in New Berlin. Good afternoon, Debbie. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Hey, Daniel.
Hi. Hey. Nice to hear from you.
Yeah, I know. You know who I am, right?
Yes, he does.
Yes, I do.
What do you got for us, Debbie?
Well, I just wanted to say, if Daniel had read Washington Black, I just finished that, and it was really one of the best books I've ever read.
Oh, I know. I've heard so much good things. It showed up on almost every top 10 list. I think it was like number 5 on the top 10s of top 10s. Won the Giller Prize, which I love Canadian writers, so I'm really excited about that. But I was going to read it at the end of the year, and my sales rep said, no, I want you to lead a book club in it, so save it for when it comes out in paperback. But what he doesn't know is his story led to a few more minutes on the book. So it is, you want to talk? Tell a little about what you loved about it.
Well, I just thought, I really am drawn to long kind of epic books about like a sort of at least half the lifespan of an individual, and it follows this young slave boy, and he basically is freed by the master dies, and then the master's brother takes him and basically frees him. Such talent in the young man that he becomes this gentleman's assistant. And he's an abolitionist, but he's also a scientist, and he becomes this gentleman's assistant, and he just turns out to be a genius, and he nurtures this young man and basically helps him find freedom. And then they lose touch, and then they find one another kind of along the way later in life. And it's just a really, really well-done, descriptive, really interesting book that...
It's one of those big fat novels that you just can't stop.
So if you're into it, you're set for a while.
That's right. This is not a one-night, well, it could be a special person's one-night read.
Wow. Now, I want to get back to your list, Daniel. We're talking, by the way, to Daniel Golden, Boswell Books in Milwaukee, looking at some of his best fiction of 2018. Another one, The Maze at Windermere by Gregory Blake Smith. I saw the cover of this one, and I recall liking the cover, but I didn't open it. Tell us about this one. It's on your list.
The cover is excellent.
The cover.
I have to agree.
If we're judging books by covers.
I love books that jump around in time but that focus on a place. So one of the big books this year was Barbara Kingsolver's Unsheltered, for example, and that was set in Vineland, New Jersey in contemporary times, and then in the 1880s when it was a utopian community. Well, but for people who think that jumping around in two periods of time is not enough, The Maze at Windermere is set in five different periods, all in the same part of Newport, Rhode Island, and many times in the same estate. So the contemporary story is about this ne'er-do-well pro-tennis player who falls in love with this heiress, and he's struggling financially. She is very wealthy, and all well and good, except some people think he might be marrying her for her money because she has cerebral palsy. So as it jumps back in time, you see all the themes that play out in the Gilded Age, in the Revolutionary War, in the Civil War, and in colonial times. And it's very playful. So, for example, in the contemporary story, people are reading Henry James, and in the Civil War story, Henry James is a character because he lived in Newport. There's so many things that we don't know about Newport as a center for the South during they would vacation there and bring their slaves, even though the North was a free state. Antisemitism, sexuality. I actually learned about this book. It was recommended to me by the novelist Jane Hamilton. She has amazing taste, and I basically listen to whatever she tells me to do. And so, big fan. I just want to say one of my books, Educated, is a memoir, and some people say that's nonfiction, but if you're European, memoirs are fiction.
Huh.
That's why I did that there. Throw that into the
okay.
Mix.
Another Facebook commenter shared a book that he liked named James. He said the book Hope Never Dies by Andrew Schaefer. It's a mystery thriller starring former Vice President Joe Biden and President Barack Obama. And James hopes that there would be a follow-up book to that. Are you familiar with that?
Yes. Oh, it's been a big hit. And yes, there is a second book coming, James. So... get excited.
Wow.
And I've heard wonderful things. I didn't read it yet, but I would like to, and I've heard wonderful things about it.
All right, I got to read this. A listener tweets, N.K. Jemisin's The Fifth Season.
Oh.
Last book of the trilogy. I read it in 2018. I checked. It came out in 2017. This is my slam. I'm reading everything I can by N.K. Jemisin. My slam dunk recommendation for people who like science fiction with great characters, great setting, a lot going on. I love this one. So thanks to the listener who tweeted
I was going to recommend it to you.
Okay, too late.
You already read them.
I'm there.
What books are you looking forward to reading this year?
Well, one of the things that's crazy is I, of course, read a little ahead. And so I've already read some books that I was really excited about. I really love the Nick Petrie series, The Drifter, set in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. The fourth book is set in Memphis, and it's called Tear It Down. That's coming out in a couple of weeks. I'm really excited about that. I read a book that there was a lot of buzz on by a guy named Christopher Castellani. I've read him in the past. He's written books about the Italian history in Wilmington, Delaware, but this is sort of about artists in Italy in the 1950s, and it's I'm trying to compare. I don't remember who I'm comparing it to because I didn't think about that.
Hey, one more book. We just have a minute. Let's sneak one more book in from your current list. 30 seconds on The Overstory by Richard Powers.
Oh my gosh. Oh, well, that is actually our best-selling novel that we did not have an event for.
Okay.
And Richard Powers has been writing. This is his 12th book. He's been writing forever. He's a writer's writer, and this book just exploded. It's five interconnected narratives with nine characters, I think, and they're all connected by trees. If you like the book, The Hidden Life of Trees, this is the novel form, including one of the characters is sort of the fake author of that book.
That sounds fantastic. That would look good to me. Daniel, thanks so much. It's always a lot of fun to talk to you about books.
Thank you.
Or anything, whatever. That's Daniel Golden, owner of Boswell Books in Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about his picks for best fiction from 2018. Hey, there's still time for you to share your favorites. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're going to have a list at WPR.org, Daniel Golden's top 10 fiction / one memoir from 2018. Check it out there. We're starting to see candidates appear in the race for president in 2020. Okay, you don't want to think about that now. I get it. But here's a way to have some fun with presidential politics. A new tool at the Washington Post lets you run anyone against anyone or anything against anything and figure out who might win.
So here's how it works. You enter two names of people or things. The tool gives you the popular vote, and it breaks down by state to give you an electoral college result.
Now, this isn't super scientific. The poll uses search trends from Google to see which of the two things win.
All right, Rob, you gave this a try. What matchups did you look at?
Okay,
well,
we love our snack foods here at Central Time, so I ran Oreos against Doritos. The winner was Doritos in a pretty big landslide, and I would have voted the other way. I'm going to eat Oreos before I eat Doritos.
See, I under normal circumstances, yes, except if there were nacho cheese Doritos.
Okay.
Then I have to go with that.
Fair. And I didn't specify that carefully. Now, I ran George Washington against Abe Lincoln. Big win for the nation's first president. We were a toss-up in Wisconsin in that one.
The Washington Post gave an example. They ran cake against pie. Cake won in 48 states, including Wisconsin.
And you suggested running football against basketball.
Yes.
Football won 538 electoral college votes. That's all of them.
Yeah. Every
Zero
single one was a
for
landslide.
Basketball. Same result, by the way. Batman over Superman. Next, we got to try Batman against cake.
Yes, and see what
that's
happens.
The race.
There you go.
Batman
there
cake 2020. Actually, that's a pretty good ticket. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.